Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, reading today from Scarlet Threads, a history of that mystery in the Bible called Babylon. We've studied it from the very beginning of time, practically, all the way now into the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries we'll be getting into. We're talking about Protestantism now and how it came out of that system. This book is not to be an endorsement of Protestantism, quote unquote, over Catholicism, though you may be shocked to hear me say that. It's not quite that simple. For example, Protestant England comes about in part as a result of the love life of Henry VIII. Henry refuses to submit to Rome in the area of marital matters. He then seizes control of the church, a la Constantine. And the history of the Church of England is also filled with Babylonian deception, political intrigue, and much bloodshed, as true followers of Jesus are asked to pay with their lives even there, a true daughter of the Roman abomination. Nevertheless, there are steps taken toward biblical Christianity during those days, not the least of which is the King James Bible, authorized by England's reigning monarch in 1611. But Babylon has taken its effect on its daughters, and this influence is passed through the English church to the Puritans, who on our shores have become a similarly repressive and intolerant bunch at times. Ever heard of the Salem witch trials? Well, Babylonian ways have cropped up in other churches descending from Rome or infiltrated by Rome. Oh, Babylon is with us, and God's clarion call to come out must be heeded by many Protestants today as well as the Roman-dominated people. No one knows this better in the 18th century than the Wesley brothers, John and Charles, whose godly mother, Susanna, nurtures them in the ways of the Lord and makes them hungry for the things of God. This hunger is still manifest when, as young men, they are students at Oxford University and become a part of a group of young seekers who are scorned and called, among other things, Methodists. They do things by a certain method, a certain way. The Wesleys belong to the Church of England, but this Roman-style religion does not fill their hearts with joy. After the Oxford days, they come to America's shores, and there they experience the grace of God. Their books, their songs, and testimony have become classic church history. And I'm calling them in here to testify to Protestants reading this work. And I charge them with a solemn word from God, from John Wesley. It's called A Word to a Protestant. If you're a Protestant today, please listen to John Wesley. Among the errors of Rome, he says, may be numbered their doctrine of seven sacraments, of transubstantiation, of communion in one kind only, of purgatory and praying for the dead therein, of veneration of relics and of indulgences. It is thought by some that these errors, great as they are, do only defile the purity of Christianity. But it is sure the following strike at its very root and tend to banish true religion out of the world. And they are, first, the doctrine of merit. The very foundation of Christianity is that a man can merit nothing from God, that we are justified freely by his grace, not for any of our works or any of our deservings, but by faith in the blood of the covenant. But the papists hold, says John Wesley, that a man may by his works merit or deserve eternal life. Second, the doctrine of praying to saints and worshiping of images. To the Virgin Mary they pray in these words, O Mother of God, O Queen of Heaven, command thy Son to have mercy upon us. And the right use of images, says the Council of Trent, is to honor them by bowing down before them. John Wesley goes on to say this is gross, open, palpable idolatry. Third, the doctrine of persecution. The papists in general still maintain that all heretics ought to be compelled to receive what they call the true faith, to be forced into the church or out of the world. This tends to bring in blind, bitter zeal, anger, hatred. So plain is it that these grand popish doctrines of merit, idolatry, and persecution, by destroying both faith and the love of God and of our neighbor, tend to banish true Christianity out of the world. End of quote. Now pause a moment here. Let nobody say that the loving Wesleys could not cry out against Rome. But take a deep breath and listen again to this same John Wesley. Quote, "Well might our forefathers protest against these. Hence it was that they were called Protestants, Protestants. You publicly protest against these horrible errors of popery. But does your heart agree with your lips? First, how do you hope to be saved? By doing thus and thus? By doing no harm and paying every man his own and saying your prayers and going to church? Alas! Now have you thrown off the mask. This is popery barefaced. Where is Christ all this time? Why, he has not come in until you get to the end of your prayer, and then you will say, 'For Jesus Christ's sake,' because so it stands in your book. Your very foundation is popish. You trample upon the blood of the covenant. Second, are you clear of idolatry? Oh, they set up their idols in their churches. You set up yours in your heart. They worship the picture of the Queen of Queens. You, the picture of the Queen of, or King of England. How small preeminence has the money worshiper at London over the image worshiper at Rome, or the idolizer of a living sinner over him that prays to a dead saint? Does the Pope force another man's conscience? Well, do you not wish the government would put down such and such people? You know what you would do if you were in their place. Be a real Protestant. By the Spirit of God assisting you, cast away all hope of being saved by your own works. Put away your idols out of your heart. And if you love God, you will love your brother also. You'll be ready to lay down your life for his sake. So far from any desire to take away his life or hurt a hair of his head, be zealous for God. But remember that the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. That angry zeal, though opposing sin, is the servant of sin. That true zeal is only the flame of love." I imagine that spoke to somebody. We're going on here. Section 44 in my book, America's Beginnings. We're going to talk more specifically later of the confusion of spiritual tongues in the big world called Christendom. But now to America, which henceforth will be an intricate part of our story. Native Americans and Roman missionaries aside for the moment, we're aware that this nation was founded in part by those who sought refuge from Babylon and her daughters. Nevertheless, the refuge is not total. America accepts in its midst, because of its stance for freedom, those who are totally opposed to that freedom. Every election year, the socialists, the gay lobby, the abortionists, they all have their freedom to be. So it is not surprising that Rome also is permitted to sell its wares in the fledgling colonies. The city of Baltimore early becomes Catholic Central in America, but it is not granted its charter until promising to grant freedom of religion to all. That was a bitter pill for, for Marylanders to swallow. Maryland, did you ever wonder why that state is called Maryland? You see, of course, freedom for all. Everyone knows that that's what this nation is about. But Babylonians in this country only slowly, and some would say never, accept American premises for government. And Babylonians in Babylon are opposed to Americanism to this day. Now it's time for another pulpit pounding. Are you awake? Are you listening? Would you hear me well? Those who find the conclusions of this book revolting, and it's becoming more obvious what those conclusions are, they need to consider the following truism. For those in the know, please forgive the obviousness of this statement. Here's my statement. Rome, alias Babylon, only does, but always does, what she is permitted to do by the prevailing political powers. She is a backrider and not always a pace setter, though she desires both positions. I hope you heard that. She does what she's allowed to do. She's not allowed to do what she used to do. But if she gained power again, well, you know the rest. Americans of the near 21st, now 21st century, are dumbfounded by charges of world domination leveled at such a nice, moral people as the Catholics. And I've got to ask you to forget for a moment the swell guy next door who rushed your child to the hospital, or the lady who watched your house while you were on vacation, or the family that offered you a drink when you were sweating from raking your leaves, or the ones who invited you to a ball game, even came to one of your prayer meetings. This story is not about Catholics. We're talking about a system that grabbed hold of the young church and still won't let go of millions of people all over the world. I want you to tune in to the institution that murdered born-again Christians while saving babies from abortion, that despises Jews while weeping over Palestinians, that controls empires, that is in fact an empire itself, that lives lavishly while decrying the world's poverty, that is blatantly immoral when no one speaks out against her, that deceives when there is no one to investigate her claims, that teaches outrageous blasphemies, though much more quietly now that the separated brothers, the Protestants, are talking about unity. Hey, that institution still lives and will do what she's always done when given a chance. Hey, live for a while in Argentina, Spain, or any Catholic-dominated land, except lands like Croatia, where you might have been killed for being non-Catholic, and feel up close the pressure of the enticing, yes, crushing embrace of a woman atop a beast. This is the lady who made her way to America centuries ago. And I must say it again, when I speak of Rome, I'm speaking of a system, not a people group. Definitely not the body of Christ that manages to survive within her walls. And yes, there are some, don't write them off. Let's move on. I think we've got time for one more little section here. Yeah, let's do the Mexican problem. The Mexican problem, the 19th century, by the time it closes, it's going to bring us within striking distance of the memories of some people living today. The story we will tell will soon lose the aura of ancient history and become very real. And I beg my readers to understand that it's the same story that we're telling throughout the whole book. It's all connected. For the following years, we switch to the Americas as a backdrop, and we focus on papal activities here in America. It may be assumed that other threads are intact, though. For example, in 1826, Pope Leo XII reinstates Pius VI's restrictions on Jewish people. Pius has already resurrected all the former oppressions that I've been reporting. Leo goes a step further and bans Jewish students from public schools and universities. Jew-hating still prominent in Babylon of the 1800s. And yes, the same Babylonian doctrines are being passed on, the same lust for power. But that power finds a growing opposition in the 19th century world. Following the French and American revolutions, many people will settle for nothing less than freedom. If you look at the map of North America in that period, it would show a place called Mexicana. Mexicana sprawled out over most of the continent. By this century, the Pope's ambitions are curtailed a bit. There's a guy named Juarez that set up a republic. Oh, no. And you can still go to the city of Juarez across the Rio Grande River from Texas. To this day, it's still there. But the man that gave that city the name was Juarez. He sets up a republic. That's the R word to the papacy. Republic? Oh, no. That's where people can be free and rule themselves. He's confiscated all of Rome's holdings for his people, and Papa is disturbed to no end. So in Roman fashion, he finds his own people to rule Mexico. Prince Maximilian of the Habsburgs that we talked about, and Princess Carlotta are to become the emperor and the empress there in 1864. Now, that's the same year as the Pope's infamous Syllabus of Errors, in which he condemns the separation of church and state and other American-style freedoms. Hello, are you listening? With papal celebration and blessing, the handsome couple are sent just south of our borders to overcome Juarez and his republic and to regain all that the church has lost. And the mission is a success, at least for a while. And I share this history to help my listeners understand that the popes have interfered in Western civilization in this hemisphere only a short time ago, relatively. Whenever possible, they'll do it again. It's within Rome's blood to conquer. Maximilian's efforts eventually fail in Mexico. Napoleon III of Catholic France also withdraws his involvement in the project, and history takes a different turn. But the all-out papal-blessed effort to take over Mexico, and perhaps with it the United States, needs to be looked at very carefully, especially when we know of the other major event going on at precisely the same time. It was America's Civil War. We're blinded by our own view of history. And I believe it's a true view, but that's all we see, us. Most people in America don't realize all that was at stake in the slavery Lincoln Civil War episode. I'm going to relate later what Southern connections Rome had. But the evidence is all there, and earnest seekers can find it today. The Pope wanted this land of ours for himself. Pius IX, in his Syllabus, claims that church and state separation is a principal error of our time. If it's an error, it's got to be corrected. And who better than Papa to correct errors like that? Well, we're going to take a break from the Americas, and let's take a break from any more talking today. That's as far as we can take it. Thank you so much for being here. Do come back. Let's finish this story. There's several other books to go, parts to the book to go, and I don't want you to miss out on any of it. And this is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, we will talk again. Real soon. Bye-bye.